those that are classified as the new wine, those are the ones that I will preserve. And this was the principle that God followed, so that he wouldn't destroy them all. If we picked up a cluster of grapes and said, well, I like to have the juice out of these grapes, but look at all these other things here, the husk and the seeds and the stems, let's just throw the whole thing away. No, there's a method that you go through to preserve and to get the new wine out, and then you destroy the other things. You have no more need for the rest of the cluster. And so that's the lesson he's teaching here in this passage. Now the initial fulfillment of this was when God's people were carried into Babylonian captivity, and God made provisions for the righteous ones to be preserved. And also, as they came through that captivity for 70 years, he still made arrangements for the righteous ones to be preserved and let them go back to the land, or that remnant was saved. And this is the type and the figure that he uses to describe this. It also has an application as we think of Christ himself. When Christ was born and went through his ministry in Palestine, there were very few people who were following after the things of God. The people had gone astray, and they even rejected the Messiah. But in that sense, we may say that Christ was the new wine, and he was in the cluster. He was in Israel, the cluster, but he was preserved, and those who were his followers were the preserved. They were the remnant, and the rest would be destroyed. The rest would not follow after the things of God, and they would be counted as unrighteous people. But this remnant would be preserved. And so it was found in, though, the cluster, or found in, mixed in with the wicked nation. And the same is true now today of the church. The church has gone through a state of apostasy. It fell away, not entirely. There was a remnant, and this remnant then was the one that was preserved, but they were in the cluster. That is, they were mingled in with the cluster, and they then have to be extracted from the cluster to be preserved and to not be destroyed like the rest of the cluster is. Now, this is the way it is with these grapes and with the new wine. If you just leave it in the cluster, and finally when the cluster is destroyed, then you lose the grape juice also. You lose the must. But if you take measures to extract that juice from the cluster, then you have preserved what you want, and you're in a position then to destroy what you do not want. Another very interesting thing about this is, he says, for a blessing is in it. Now, stretching this figure just a little bit, the blessing is in the new wine. The blessing is in the new wine. Well, we find in 1 Corinthians 10 a phrase that needs defining. As he's talking about the communion service there in 1 Corinthians 10 and 16, he says, the cup of blessing which we bless, is it not the communion of the blood of Christ? Now, this phrase, the cup of blessing which we bless, what is that? What is the cup of blessing? Can we define the cup of blessing? Well, the only place that we can define this in the Bible, and of course that's the only place you'll ever be able to define anything accurately, is get a Bible definition. The only place we can define this in the Bible is in our verse in Isaiah 65 and 8, in which he says, as the new wine is found in the cluster, and one said, destroy it not, for a blessing is in it. This cup of blessing then, this cup that contains something that he calls the cup of blessing, would be a cup of the new wine, or a cup of the must. And that is the definition then of the cup of blessing. And so when we participate in the communion and we say that we give thanks for this cup of blessing which we bless, the cup of blessing then is the cup of new wine. That's what has the blessing. That's the nearest thing that I can find to a definition of that in the Bible. So he says, so will I do for my servant's sake that I may not destroy them all. That's a very beautiful figure, and it's a powerful figure. And it's one that requires some study to get the full benefit of. Again in verse 9. And I will bring forth a seed out of Jacob, and out of Judah an inheritor of my mountains, and mine elect shall inherit it, and my servants shall dwell there. Still talking about the remnants now, or the remnant. The remnant will be this seed that comes out of Jacob, and this and that comes out of Judah, this inheritor of my mountains, and mine elect shall inherit it, and my servants shall dwell there. So there he does talk about the ones that are going to be left to remain and to inherit and to carry on the ways of God. Again, in verse 10, still talking along this same line, and Sharon shall be a fold of flocks, and the valley of Achor a place for the herds to lie down in, for my people that have sought me. Now this is for the remnant, for the people that have sought him. He says Sharon shall be a fold of flocks. Sharon was an area that was south of Mount Carmel. It extended from Caesarea to Joppa, which is some 60 miles. It was noted for its beauty and fertility. And those who have been there in years since still marvel at the glorious beauty of this area of Sharon. And the fertility of it, the productivity of it, the tranquility, the peace of it. Well, let's remember now, at the time this prophecy is activated, these people had been in captivity for some 70 years, and Sharon had not been inhabited. It had not been cultivated. It had not been a land of fertile flocks, but it had been desolate. And so he's promising here there that Sharon shall be a fold of flocks. There's going to come a time when my remnant are going to inhabit Sharon again. And it's going to be a fold of flock. It's going to return to its period of beauty and fertility. Then he says the Valley of Achor, a place for the herds to lie down in. Now this Valley of Achor was a valley near Jericho. It was a valley that caused the people of God much affliction, a source of calamity. And read about it in Joshua 7:24 and 15 and 7. And one that caused them a lot of anguished memories. But he says the Valley of Achor, rather than being a place that you think of as a time of affliction, the Valley of Achor will be a place for herds to lie down in. So he's portraying the beauty here and the benefit that's going to be to his people that are the remnant. That is those that have sought me, for my people that have sought me. Now, beginning in verse 11, he tells of the fact that the wicked of the nation would be cut off. And he tells about their punishment. Verses 11 through 16. He says, but ye are they that forsake the Lord, that forget my holy mountain, that prepare a table for that troop, and that furnish the drink offering unto that number. This verse is a little hard to interpret, but let's see if we can define some of the words here and get an interpretation of it. Ye are they that forsake the Lord, that forget my holy mountain. Now, that's not too hard for us to understand that. They've forsaken the Lord. They've forgotten the holy mountain. This probably has reference to Zion. Any of the holy things of God could be referred to as the holy mountain. Even today, the church age, the kingdom of heaven is referred to as his holy mountain. We have it referred to again in this chapter. So those that forget that, forget his holy mountain, forget the things that God has prepared, forget the holy things of God, that forsake the Lord. And then what do they do? You know, nobody just does nothing. Everybody, if they forsake God, then their energies are going to be spent in the direction of serving some other God, some other source, some other thing. And so that's true with these people. He says that prepare a table for that troop. Now this word here for troop is, according to the Bible scholars, not accurately translated. It should be translated as Gad, G-A-D. And the word Gad means some kind of an idolatrous god. And among many of the scholars, the thought is that it means the sun. It could mean other things, another planet or heavenly body. But it probably, if the consensus of the scholars is correct, it means the sun. So you prepare a table for that troop or for that Gad. It's referring to an idolatrous god that people were worshiping. And to prepare a table for him meant that they were preparing the ceremonial place of worship. They were involved somehow in worshiping this god or this sun. And the next phrase, and that furnished the drink offering under that number. And this word for number really should be translated as Meni, M-E-N-I, and that's another idolatrous god. Gad and Meni. There have been a lot of work done on this, and a lot of dissertations written about it, a lot of research done. And Meni probably means the moon. If Gad means the sun, Meni means the moon. So they were furnishing the drink offering for the moon. Now this was, in the Hebrew, it's a kind of a play on words between the word Meni and the word for number, as I understand it. And so that's one of the things that's kind of thrown the Bible scholars off here. But I don't mean the Bible scholars, I mean the earlier translators off. But they were furnishing the drink offering under that Meni. And here again, they were involved in the worship of this thing. Now, if the original translation, troop and number, is a correct translation, it simply means that they were providing these things for a group of people who were following false gods. Verse 12, therefore will I number you to the sword. And this word number, again, it's a kind of a takeoff from the word number in the previous verse. Therefore will I number you to the sword, and it means to determine. Whereas you have let other gods be put into the position of determining your fate, your future, I'll let you know that I am the one that determines. I'm the one that numbers. I'll number you to the sword. And this had reference to their original downfall when the Babylonians captured their land. I'll number you to the sword. And you shall all bow down to the slaughter. This is the slaughter by the Babylonian invasion. And you can read about this in 2 Chronicles 36:19. We referred to it in our last chapter. But that describes some of the things that happened. The sword and the slaughter. So God says, I'll show you that I am the one who does the numbering. I am the one who does the determining. And you'll have to recognize me then as being the one who has that power. He goes on in verse 12. Because when I called, you did not answer. When I spake, you did not hear. But did evil before mine eyes, and did choose that wherein I delighted not. Now this is why God is doing this. I called you. I invited you. I extended the invitation, and you didn't answer. I spoke. I told you what my will was, and you did not hear. But you did evil before my eyes. You elected to do evil, and you chose that wherein I delighted not. You decided to go in ways that gave me no pleasure, ways that were actually a hardship on me because I was so unhappy with those ways. This verse has got a lot of teaching here that we need to take note of. Principles. When God calls, do we answer? When He speaks, do we hear? Do we know that He has extended an invitation for us? He's not willing that any should perish, but that all should be saved. He's willing for all to repent. He's willing for all to get forgiveness of their sins. Do we know that God has made ample provisions for us to hear, to know, and to be saved? It's really rather difficult not to believe in God. It's really rather difficult to completely forget about Him because He has made Himself so abundantly known. But He says that when I called and you did not answer, when I spake you did not hear, but did choose evil before mine eyes, or did evil before mine eyes. You know, any evil that we do, we might blot God out of our remembrance while we do it, but we're doing it before God's eyes. He's observing us. He sees, He knows, and He's keeping this record that we just read about too, that's going to be opened in the judgment day. And did choose that wherein I delighted not. You know, it's a good little test for us when we choose to do something to ask ourselves the question, is this something God would like for me to do? Is this something God would be with me as I do it? Is he willing to be with me while I do this thing? Or is this something that God has no part in and he detests it? He describes that here as one of the reasons why that he numbered these people to the sword. Many of them were killed right there on the spot. It may have been only the remnant that was really allowed to go into captivity and to be preserved. Verse 13, therefore thus saith the Lord God, behold, my servant shall eat, but ye shall be hungry. Behold, my servant shall drink, but ye shall be thirsty. Behold, my servant shall rejoice, but ye shall be ashamed. Here he's showing a contrast between what his servants are going to receive from him and what those who are disobedient are going to be received. One shall eat, the other shall be hungry. One shall drink, the other shall be thirsty. One shall rejoice, the other shall be ashamed. Verse 14, continuing, behold, my servants shall sing for joy of heart, but ye shall cry for sorrow of heart, and shall howl for vexation of spirit. So the contrast is, one's going to rejoice, one's going to sing, one shall cry, and shall howl for sorrow of heart and vexation of spirit. Verse 15, and ye shall leave your name for a curse unto my chosen. For the Lord God shall slay thee, and call his servants by another name. Now this prophecy is most interesting to us. Ye shall leave your name for a curse unto my chosen. Now a curse, a name that is a curse, means that if you take this name, it'll be a curse to you to take this name. Or it could also mean that any who regard something as being accursed would connect it with this name. And look at how true that has been and is even today. The name of the Jew is actually a curse in many ways. So many people have detested just this very name. They don't know the people. They don't know the Jewish people or have an acquaintance with them in any kind of a close or knowing sense. It's just the name. They've been so schooled and so prejudiced and so turned against this name until it's actually, in many ways, a curse. So he says, you should leave your name for a curse unto my chosen. They wouldn't leave their name for a blessing, but it'd be a curse. And he says, for the Lord God shall slay thee and call his servants by another name. His servants are going to be called by another name, not by your name. And it's rather striking that today the true servants of God are called by the name Christian, another name. Verse 16, that he who blesseth himself in the earth shall bless himself in the God of truth. And he that sweareth in the earth shall swear by the God of truth, because the former troubles are forgotten, and because they are hid from mine eyes. Now this is very interesting here. He's going to slay those that were so disobedient. He would rid them from the face of the earth. He would rid their practices from among his people, the idolatrous practices, that he who blesseth himself in the earth shall bless himself in the God of truth. If you're going to receive any blessing in this earth, you get it from the true God, not from an idolatrous God, not from a false God, not from any other God, but from the true God. He that sweareth in the earth shall swear by the God of truth. That's the one God to turn to, the one God to look to, the one God to expect your blessings to come from. The former troubles are forgotten, and because they are hid from mine eyes. Now beginning in verse 17, he talks about the future glory and prosperity for his true people. This is verses 17 through verse 25, that is, through the remainder of this chapter. Verse 17, for behold, I create new heavens and a new earth, and the former shall not be remembered, nor come into mind. Now this is one of a series of beautiful figures in which God explains how that his people are going to be blessed and receive blessings from him. And in this figure, he talks about creating new heavens and a new earth. Now, those of us who believe in the creation, as it's taught by the Bible, we know that there was a time in which the heavens and the earth, as we know them, were created. They came into being by the power of God. And so God has used this figure over and over to express the idea of a new beginning, new heavens and new earth. We know when the earth was created that a new beginning was formed then. We know that during the time of the flood, and Noah and his household were saved, there again was another new beginning. We read of the destruction of sin and a community, and the destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah. And there again could be a new beginning. Here again we have the destruction of Jerusalem and the inhabitants thereof and their wicked ways and carrying it into captivity. And when they come out then and reestablish this city and this nation and the temple and the worship of God, it would be a new beginning, the creation of new heavens and a new earth. When the church was established, it was the creation of new heavens and a new earth. And yet we have, in the time of the New Testament church, the Apostle Peter also saying in 2 Peter 3:11 and 13, that we look for new heavens and a new earth. Now God several times uses the figure of destroying the heavens and the earth when he talks about ridding the evil influences in Isaiah 13:10. He says, "For the stars of heaven and the constellation thereof shall not give their light, the sun shall be darkened in his going forth, and the moon shall not cause her light to shine. And I will punish the world for their evil and the wicked for their iniquity, and I will cause the arrogancy of the pride to cease, or the proud to cease, and will lay low the haughtiness of the terrible." Again in Isaiah 34, verse 4, "And all the host of heaven shall be dissolved, and the heavens shall be rolled together as a scroll, and all their hosts shall fall down as the leaf falleth off from the vine, and as a falling fig from the fig tree." And so just as we have the destroying of heaven and earth being used as a figure of God's punishing the wickedness, we also have the reestablishing and the rebuilding of new heavens and a new earth as being a figure then of God reestablishing righteousness. In 2 Peter 3, beginning with verse 11, "Seeing then that all these things shall be dissolved, what manner of persons ought you to be in all holy conversation and godliness, looking for and hasting unto the coming of the day of God, wherein the heavens being on fire shall be dissolved, and the elements shall melt with fervent heat. Nevertheless, we, according to his promise, look for new heavens and a new earth, wherein dwelleth righteousness." And he makes a reference to this several places in the book of Isaiah that Peter could be quoting from, one of which is our chapter tonight, Isaiah 65 and verse 17. Again, we have in Revelations 21, verse 1, "And I saw a new heaven and a new earth, for the first heaven and the first earth were passed away, and there was no more sea." So you see, this is a very prevalent figure in the Bible, and it has some rather deep meaning. And the most outstanding thing to us is that this occurred when the church was established, and it also will occur when he comes again, and we have the judgment day, and the whole new order of things. Now he goes in verse 18, "But be ye glad and rejoice forever in that which I create. For behold, I create Jerusalem a rejoicing and her people a joy. And I will rejoice in Jerusalem and joy in my people, and the voice of weeping shall be no more heard in her, nor the voice of crying." Here again now, this is a prophecy that has greater and lesser fulfillments. The original and lesser fulfillment was to reestablish Jerusalem. They were to have joy, to be glad and rejoice forever in that which I create. For behold, I create Jerusalem a rejoicing and her people a joy. Now the greater fulfillment of this is the establishment of the church. God did create and establish the church, and we are to be glad and rejoice in it. Rejoice forever in that which the Lord has created. And yet there is even another Jerusalem, the Jerusalem which is above, which is the mother of us all, the heavenly Jerusalem. And there again, that we look forward to at yet a future time. And so he refers to this in verse 19, "And I will rejoice in Jerusalem, and joy in my people, and the voice of weeping shall be no more heard in her, nor the voice of crying." Here again he's talking about the great blessings that people will have in the church, in the spiritual realm, blessings so great that they will overshadow and blot out the voice of weeping and the crying. Now in verse 20 we have another figure that is very graphic and a little hard sometimes to completely make an application of. Verse 20, "There shall be no more thence an infant of days, nor an old man that hath not filled his days. For the child shall die 100 years old, but the sinner being 100 years old shall be accursed." He's simply saying in this verse that the righteous will enjoy a full length of life. They're going to fully enjoy their life. And here again we have the lesser and the greater fulfillments. But he says that there shall be no more thence an infant of days, probably meaning that no infant would reach the fullness of his life while an infant. That he would not die while an infant, but that he would be allowed to live the full life. "Nor an old man that hath not filled his days." Every old man would have completely filled the length of his life. He would not be considered to be old, nor ready to leave this life until he had filled his days, that he had completely lived his life. "For the child shall die 100 years old. Now this is an interesting thought. The child shall die 100 years old, meaning that the old person, the 100-year-old person, would actually be like a child. He would be as full of enjoyment of life. He'd be as full of vigor as a child would be, even though he was 100 years old. And when it came his time to die, he would still be as youthful as a child and getting as much enjoyment out of life. Then he says, "But the sinner being 100 years old shall be accursed." I think this is simply showing that the one who was a sinner who happened to live to be old, all sinners wouldn't die young, but the one who did happen to live to be old would be accursed. He wouldn't have a happy life. He would not enjoy his life. He would not have a fruitful and rewarding type of life, but he would be accursed. Verse 21, "And they shall build houses and inhabit them, and they shall plant vineyards and eat the fruit of them." Showing that when they got back to Jerusalem, it would not be like the former times when their houses were sacked and they were carried away and foreigners came in and invaded their land and took over all of their goods. But these people of God now would build houses and inhabit them. And they shall plant vineyards and shall eat the fruit of them. Somebody else is not going to take their place and reap the benefit of their work. "They shall not build and another inhabit. They shall not plant and another eat. For as the people..." "For as the days of a tree are the days of my people, and mine elect shall long enjoy the work of their hands." Showing that these people would be allowed to go back and inhabit the land of God, and they would not be run out. Nobody else would take their place. And that's certainly very true of the church today. When we are in the church and we do work in the church, nobody else comes in and takes the fruit of our labor and takes it away from us. We get to enjoy all that we